White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another Heretics Hour on this Monday, June 4th, 2012. I am Carolyn Yeager, and I'm broadcasting live from the White Network for the next 2 hours. This is only the second broadcast from this new network, as we're still getting the basics put together. Of course, it's not me that's doing it. it's Tan Stoffel, but I like to pretend like I'm a part of doing all of this. And I want you to know that while I hope that I sound calm and collected, I'm a little bit nervous because I'm doing this program by myself. With my trusty SkyCon computer guy aiding me. And so this is a new experience for me, but it's really cool the way it works. So I will just continue on now that I've tried to make you be impressed with me a little bit and tell you that there's going to be a 5-minute musical interlude at the top of the hour. Otherwise, there are no interruptions other than that in this program. And I have no guests tonight, but I do have a couple of announcements to start with. First, on June, today is the 4th, on the 8th, which is the 45th anniversary of the unprovoked Israeli attack on the USS Liberty, an American intelligence gathering ship. And this attack caused numerous deaths and many serious injuries of the crew and the near sinking of the ship. I'm sure everybody listening is totally aware of this, but I will just add that the continuing cover-up of such a war crime is an example of the kind of Jewish power that we are dealing with. This has been 45 years now, and this is still being covered up. And I'm announcing this because of Zan Overall, who is organizing a demonstration in Hollywood in front of the CNN building at 6430 Sunset Boulevard on June 8th. And so those of you who are in that area, who are in that vicinity or can get there, want to get there, this is where it's at, close to Sunset and Vine. It's on the south side of Sunset, a few blocks west of Vine, Zan says. And this is in Hollywood, California, on June 8th. Now, on June 9th, I hope to have my first Saturday afternoon with Carolyn program from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern time. But it's not a sure thing. And so you and I both need not to get our hopes up too high. But if I do have the program, if everything goes well tonight, and that seems to be going, then we feel we can do that. My guest is going to be Vincent Renoir from Paris. Vincent Renoir, the well-known revisionist, and just a wonderful man, and I'm so looking forward to having him as a guest. He's prepared to be here on the 9th, so let's hope that we can have the program. And if not, well, that's the way it goes. But you will see it announced on my website, and I will send out an announcement to the people on my mailing list. And by the way, I could add that if you want to get announcements of my radio programs and other things some of my writings and so on, just go to my website, carolynyeager.com, or it's also carolynyeager.net, both the same thing, and sign up. Under my picture, there's a place for newsletter sign up. It's not really a newsletter. It's just a mailing that I send out now and then. You won't be inundated. There's maybe two or three, maybe even sometimes for a week, but not very often that many. But that includes the radio shows. So Now, to get to the subject of my program tonight, it's a very controversial subject, and I will just open it up by mentioning a story that came out just today that I saw this morning from this Jason Alexander, who was on the Seinfeld show. Back when, a long time ago, I was a big fan of the Seinfeld show, as most people were. It was one of the things that I usually watched. They were all Jewish, which I didn't even realize at the time. But in this today, Jason Alexander got into a one of those sticky things because he used the word gay and called the cricket game a gay game, you know, the British sport called cricket. And this was on the CBS Late Late Show. Late Late Show, and yet because, here's what he said. He said, it's the pitch. It's the weirdest. It's not like a manly baseball pitch. It's a queer British gay pitch. Well, right away, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation came out and attacked him for what he said, and he has now apologized and said all the usual things that said he has many gay friends and he should have known better than to say that. So somehow they want us all, they want us to use the word gay, but they don't want to have themselves insulted in any way, shape, or form. That was just a little tidbit, but what's more important to me, and if you saw my announcement for this program, you saw the image of the comic book image of the two males kissing in a close embrace. And this comes from the fact that on June 1st, the DC comic book hero Green Lantern was reintroduced as a homosexual. And this was, there was news about this and lots of some pictures, and there was quite a few of the strips, frames or strips from that comic book that you can link to. If you just Google that, you'll find it. And they say in that the Green Lantern of the series Earth 2 will be reintroduced as a gay man in June. Alan Scott is this guy's name. As when he's not the Green Lantern, he's Alan Scott, I guess. And I have to say that I never heard of Green Lantern. I never saw a Green Lantern comic book in my childhood when I was a big comic book fan, like everybody, like all kids. And we didn't have that in my neck of the woods, I guess. So I've never heard of him before. But he is. He was the first man to wield the green power ring in 1940, and now he's welcomed home with a kiss from his boyfriend in the upcoming issue of Earth 2. And I will have a little bit more to say about that later. Now I'm going to get right into my subject and why I chose such a sensitive topic as this, which is not just homosexuality in our culture, but homosexuality among white nationalism and among white nationalists and in white nationalism. It's not something I've been thinking about. It's not something I even planned even a week ago. I just decided last Thursday after I listened to the latest posted Stark Truth program on Voice of Reason. I heard some things that I had never heard before. So I started investigating, and once I did, I found out so many things. And I'm not saying that some people don't know about it, don't know these things, but I don't know if they've. I doubt very many people have put all this together. So as I did so, I just knew I couldn't keep it to myself, and so I decided to devote this program to it. That's the way I am when I get onto something. I usually never know from one week to next what my program is going to be. I don't plan sometimes, but most of the time I don't know. When I finish one Monday night Heretics Hour, I have no idea what's going to be the topic for the next Monday night. And I like to kind of keep it fresh and not plan ahead too much. So that's one reason why it works that way. And something always comes up. And this came up. So now, I want to also mention in connection with this, even though it is no direct connection whatsoever, but it's just the increasing amount of homosexuality that we're hearing about in our culture. There's also a story that some of you probably saw just a couple days ago of this Canadian porn star who has an Italian name, who is being hunted for murdering and cannibalizing his Chinese lover. There's been a lot of cannibalizing going on. And I know that Mike Connor was talking about it last Friday. This kind of over-the-top grisly story is just becoming more commonplace as our society degenerates because of migration and race mixing. I have a link here to that story, but it's really sickening. But, you know, this man, porn actor, young guy, he's an example of about as bad as things can get. And he's white. All right, I'm going to start now with this interview on the Robert Stark Show at VOR that I heard on Thursday, I guess. It took place, on May 23rd. The show ran on May 23rd. It was Robert Stark interviewing James O'Meara. I had never heard of James O'Meara before, but this is the one where they have a image of his horoscope as the image there. And that kind of intrigued me. And I wanted to see what that was all about. I didn't even read the bullets when I first started to listen to it. But he said some very interesting things that really perked up my attention. I will say, I'll just try to go in order here, that this program page from the Voice of Reason was reproduced as a blog post on Countercurrents, which is edited by Greg Johnson. Because obviously, he thought it was an important interview. And so he posted it on his own, website. Now, O'Meara, I checked and found that O'Meara has 25 articles posted at Countercurrent since December 2012, which is about a year and a half ago. So, that shows that, and he talks about Greg. So, O'Meara is very friendly with the people at Countercurrents, and he has had, this is a lot of articles, 25 in a year and a half. Now, O'Meara makes no bones that he's homosexual. And his own weblog, he talks, you know, he's not hiding it at all. It's obvious in his interview with Robert Stark. His weblog is Where the Wild Boys Are. That's the title of it, Where the Wild Boys Are. Of course, I went there and looked that over, and he has on his site of the four blogs he says he follows, one is Queer Attack the System. There's an Attack the System, you know, which and he recommends on there. On Queer Attack the System, they recommend Attack the System, which is the anarchist website of Keith Preston, who is another host at Voice of Reason. But this, the one that O'Meara recommends is Queer Attack the System, and they are, of course, queers. So, and they're anarchists. And I'm just pointing out the interconnection among these men, which is going to become more and more numerous as I continue. So, in that interview, on his website, Where the Wild Boys Are, O'Meara tells a lot about himself. It doesn't show a photo of himself, though. Instead, he has a picture of a blonde, good-looking blonde in shorts and stiletto-heeled boots playing what looks like it might be a ukulele, something like that. And it's kind of all in good fun, I'm sure. For his interests, he lists national anarchism, conservative revolution, ethnogenic origins of religion, heavy metal as popular mystery cult, homosexuals as a natural elite, new and old right. The homosexuals as a natural elite is what interests me. And if I had ever known of him or gone to his website, which I never have any reason to do, I would have learned a lot about him before I ever heard that interview. Now, among his favorite books, he lists Spengler, Ernst Junger, Gregor and Otto Strasser, Nouvelle Droit, something French, Alain de Benoist, Guillaume Fay, who are mentioned fairly often amongst the people at Voice of Reason, Michael Walker, Tomislav Sunich, whom we know well, Horror, Poe, Lovecraft, Thomas Ligotti. I'm just saying that these are things we find all around the New Right. The New Right is paraded as something that is really important and rather a high level intellectual and something that is leading us into our white future. You know, our new white future for white nationalism, the New Right is it. Now, so I'm just saying that it's one thing is very, very, very clear, and that is that James O'Meara is a homosexual, and he's not trying to hide it either. So I'm not, you know, that's one thing you can say for him. You know, he's quite honest about it. Now, here are some of the things that he said during the program, which I found surprising in my, I guess, protected status that I am, my protected world that I live in. He says that Semitic ideas have to be rooted out of white society. Okay. And then he says, what are those ideas? Well, in so many words, he says they are homophobic ideas. Homophobia is Semitic, that is Jewish. It's the Jewish idea. He says that in line with Julius Evola, who I never really cared for Julius Evola at all, but O'Meara has found that the origins, the roots of white civilization, white culture is in a male group. This is the roots of white civilization, white culture are found in a male group, something that has a name in German that's popular, a popular name that's often used, and that is a Männerbund. Männerbund, M-A-N-N-E-R-B-U-N-D, with the umlaut over the A. And this he describes as a primitive or archaic group of men. Well, I may have found that in the dictionary, I don't know. But a primitive or archaic group of men who are separated from society, who are the creators of the Aryan state and Aryan culture. And it's something that's unique to Aryan civilization. He says that one who has written about this is Alistair Clark, a British member of the New Right, who O'Meara likes and who has a blog called Aryan Futurism. I looked that up and I found that really interesting. The blog Aryan Futurism by Alistair Clark, a friend of O'Meara's, and he wrote in 2006, he may not be keeping this blog up. This was a link from O'Meara's site, and it may be that there was, I couldn't find a current homepage. But anyway, this quote from 2006, it says, homosexuals have a long and honorable tradition as culture bearers and for fighting for and defending their tribes and later nations. Now, when the survival and evolution of Western civilization itself is at stake, the duty of all brave, aware, truthful, and well-meaning gay men is self-evident. Homosexuals must act as white blood cells ready to attack any invasion of the Western body politic. Well, that sounds, you know, very noble, but we have to remember that these are homosexuals putting themselves in this position as the defenders and the defenders of white society and white survival and white evolution. And yet, you know, they don't marry, they don't have children. So it's a little bit strange, but they do it. They don't, you know, they don't have families. And so they are able to, according to some of them, they'll say this, which we'll hear later. They do this. They're more able to do this because they're not tied down to families and and all those Jewish values that that brings with them. All right, so back to Amira. Also on his side, he said of Jews. No, he said this on the program. Now I'm in the Stark interview. Okay, Amira said, Jews play both sides. They want to exterminate, well, they say, you know, exterminate the homosexuals is the Jewish position, he says. And liberals and Democrats are perceived as pro-homosexual, but they are not, he says. He says the left, since Stonewall, now some of you will know, some probably not, that there was a, this was a homosexual political Democratic Party faction in the 60s that they named themselves Stonewall, and they got they managed to win through to some political power in the Democratic Party at that time. That's all I can tell you about it. But he says the left since Stonewall has taken on a fake identity of Rainbow Coalition, in quotes. Homos, prior to Stonewall, were usually people of the right, he says. And he doesn't mind using the word homo. In fact, he is writing a book, which will be out soon, called The Negro and the Homo. I didn't get what that was going to be about. Exactly, but he didn't say enough about it. So, but anyway, that's it. So he says homos prior to Stonewall were usually people of the right in favor of elitism, not like we generally think, which people of the left. But they were, it was co-opted. They were co-opted, these right-wing homos. The left attacks the Männerbund, which he says is not necessarily homosexual. Okay, this Männerbund, this group of men, these important group of men who are the culture carriers and the culture creators for white society, he says, are not necessarily homosexual, but homoerotic. And he distinguishes between the two. And he says that the left's version of homosexuality is gay marriage. The right's version of homosexuality is this Männerbund. Put in, you know, simplistic terms. Okay, now, what I learned, which kind of surprised me that they come right out and say it. You know, it just surprised me that it was, and it was surprised me that it was on Voice of Reason Radio, that these guys, I call them, these men, these homosexual men, in, you know, in this fairly large network, are not interested in marriage. Of course, they're not. But they look down on marriage and family values as being kind of a lesser type. These are lesser souls and lesser types of people who are the ones who are engaging in this so that we have we can, you know, continue continue bringing new people into the world. But they are on a higher level. They are above that. And they do look down on it. They might say they don't, but in everything that you read from these places, that's basically what they're saying. Let's see. I better hurry up here. I'm not going to cover all this. By taking men out of the family and out of the family values system, such as with priests and monks, this is something. This is what Amira was saying. Then their job, you do that so to give them the job to create culture. Okay. These males are a natural elite who are taken out of the family the way that we used to do it, with priests and monks, you know, because they had a special job to perform that was, you know, they couldn't be caught up in nasty family life and child rearing and so on. They had to serve God. And these men are doing the same thing. They're serving their gods, and they're serving the gods of the white community in their estimation, which are basically most of the time pagan. They prefer paganism over Christianity. Their job is to create culture for the rest of us. Therefore, you know, when I take this, well, we don't create our own. We cannot only, you know, we're not capable of it. And when you look at a lot of their websites, they're very esoteric, and They're very high. They're on a very high level, and they recommend all these esoteric books, and they talk about all these esoteric things. And, you know, this is what they like, and they show a lot of art, and or sometimes it's kind of low level. You never know where they're going to go with it. Okay, I'll leave that. At one point, O'Meara complained that the Catholic Church, the public schools, the Boy Scouts, bodybuilders, and that is anyone not getting married and moving to the suburbs, are accused of being crypto-homo. He was saying that if you don't fit in, if you don't, you know, get married and you don't move to the suburbs and you don't have that ordinary, esoteric life that they prefer, even if you're just the Catholic Church or you're the public schools, they're accused of being crypto-homo. He says has been greatly influenced by Julius Evola and René Guénon. Now, these are two people that are mentioned a lot among the New Right. I already told you I cannot warm up to Julius Evola. I've never tried to read René Guénon, but he writes about Eastern metaphysical doctrines. And I did involve myself in that quite a bit in an earlier period of my life, so I'm not ignorant of it. I haven't put much attention on it for a long time, but I know what it's all about. And anyway, René Guénon exemplifies what countercurrents.com is all about. I want to tell you that I've been a reader of Countercurrents for a while now. I've liked it. It's a good-looking website. I've liked Greg Johnson. I've liked a lot of things, but I'm having to look at, now that I'm looking more deeply, I'm seeing things that are quite surprising to me. And this is why I'm doing this show. Because I like to talk about what I'm currently thinking about, but also I think that most people don't look deeply and don't pay this kind of attention. And it didn't really take me that long. I wouldn't have either, as I didn't until this week. So this past week, last week. So anyway, to continue with René Guénon, he was a French author and intellectual who died in 1951. He studied Eastern metaphysical doctrines and sought to adapt them to Western minds. He's considered a brilliant genius and by a large number of people now. And in 1930, he moved to Cairo permanently, according to a general history of him. He married a Muslim woman then. So he moved from, or maybe he just embraced Islam along with the Vedanta and so on from the East, and he devoted the rest of his life, it says, to Islam. And from there, I want to take you to the about section, on the top of the page at the Countercurrents web page under about. It says that Countercurrents takes its guiding principles from French traditionalist René Guénon, his book The Crisis of the Modern World, and it lists there a bunch of, several items of information that obviously are very important to the Countercurrents philosophy. And I'm going to read them. I'm going to go right through them pretty quick. History is cyclical, and its prevailing current is downward, declining from a golden age through silver and bronze ages to a dark age. And this is the Vedantic doctrine, or part of it. Continue. We live in a dark age. Now, we are now in the dark. We're now in almost the darkest of the dark age, in which decadence reigns and all natural and healthy values are inverted. And of course, I guess family, I'm adding this, that family must be considered part of the dark ages, because when they talk about the golden age, that's the age of the gods, and we know the gods didn't have family in the way that we think of it, although they did have some offspring here and there. Even in the depths of the Dark Ages, there are hidden Golden Age countercurrents, survivals of the past Golden Age that sustain the world and serve as seeds of the Golden Age to come. It is not futile to think and live according to Golden Age principles in the depths of the Dark Age, Indeed, those who do so play an important role in the passage of the ages. Knowledge has practical consequences. Countercurrents aims to hasten the dissolution of the Dark Age by promoting knowledge of its deficiencies in the light of tradition, tradition with a capital T. Julius Evola is one of the mainstays that is pointed to when you talk when they talk about tradition. Two more, last two. Countercurrents also aims to promote the survival of essential ideas and texts into Golden Age to come. And Countercurrents publishes, distributes, and promotes books against time. I don't know if Savitra Devi came up with Against Time or if she got it from somewhere else, but that's a, kind of a well-known concept that we, in the Dark Ages, you have to function against time because time is on the side of the dark forces. So, all right, now back to James O'Meara. He also mentions Kai Mouros, who now I think that he maybe is homosexual because everybody that O'Meara mentions is homosexual. He mentions Justin Raimondo. Noel Coward is one of his, he's a big fan of Noel Coward, who was a famous homosexual in a movie, in the movies. And he is studying his movies to construct a new right philosophy. And Hunter Thompson, William Burroughs, David Bowie or Bowie, Oscar Wilde, these are all homosexuals. He names only these kind of men when he speaks of who he approves of or who he reads or who we should read. Now, I already said that, I intimated that he and Greg Johnson are good friends. The program, as I already told you, was reposted on Countercurrents. And did I tell you yet that, I'm sure I did, that he's had 45 of his articles have been posted on Countercurrents. Yes, I did. Now, to continue, now, all these men make it clear that families are the lowest common denominator. And this is my interpretation, now my wording, but I think it's, it, you know, I will say it, they see it sort of like animal life, you know, very much like the Jews in that they see themselves as the chosen, but they are strictly, they only like what is white. You know, I'll give them that. They seem to be loyal to the white race, but not to all of our values because they be on a higher level. And they dismiss family life and children because naturally they don't participate in it, and they don't see it as something they'd want to participate in. But since family life is how our race continues, and male groups get their female breeders from, you know, this way. You have to have female breeders, and you have to have their new males from which they can choose their favorites and so on, the ones that qualify for becoming a part of the male elite, because it's an ongoing thing. So it's not that there's a super authority supervising all this, but according to anything I've read by them, but that people will naturally gravitate to where they fit in, or they'll be chosen to go where they fit in, and everyone will be happy that way. Now, O'Meara also likes movies, and so does Johnson and quite a few of the others. They are movie buffs, and they do a fair bit of movie criticism. In talking about movies, O'Meara said that the real men were out west. They didn't stay in the east with their families. Real men have no wives. They have guns. I added that. They have guns. They don't conform to social rules. I added that. I mean, this is the idea of real men, which somehow fits homosexuals in their mind. So what we have is that the Judaic model is what today would be called family values. That's what they say. You know, that family values come from the Jewish people from the Old Testament. This is what really caught my attention when I listened to this program the first time. Now, they're saying that the Aryan model is actually then homosexuality. And they're trying to take the Aryan idea and make themselves be the representatives of that. And I see this more and more, which some things I'll point out, as a rather serious, concerted agenda. It's not just a happenstance thing that somebody happens to say, because it's echoed in too many places by others. So I will mention another homosexual who's right out in the open. That's Jack Donovan. He's been on Robert Stark's show twice, and he's been published 14 times on the Countercurrents website since October 31st, 2011, when he had his first one published, according to what's in his archives. And so that was 7 months. So in 7 months, 14 articles published. That's twice a month. Simple math. That's quite a lot, I would say. Between O'Meara and Donovan, they're pretty well. And then there's others. There are others. There are other homosexuals. I didn't focus on them. I don't know for sure, because a lot don't say that they are, but you're kind of pretty sure that they are. But anyway, these two are enough for me to see how many times they've been on there. So Donovan is one who focuses on strong males. He says that weak men are a liability. I think he means that married men are weak, because if they're, he says, well, you know, if he, the way he talks about women, you know, he's always fairly respectful, but it's clear that women have no role in his vision of the world. They're just, there they are, you know, and they just pull men down and they become feminists and so on. So and they make men weak. So you want to stay clear of women. And he says that we live in a matriarchal society, which I think is just downright false. As a woman, I have known all my life that I did not live in a matriarchal society, but I have lived in a society that is kind and gives women a very comfortable place, but it is not a matriarchal society. And I'm not a fan of radical feminism. Is not my cup of tea, and it never was, so nobody can accuse me of that, although many have tried. So what I say when he says we live in a matriarchal society and weak men are a liability, well, liability to what and to who? I don't, you know, it just doesn't, he's just making things up to fit his philosophy. That's how I see it. All right, now I'm not too anxious to talk about, I'm going to talk now about Greg Johnson himself, and I've already explained how I've felt and looked upon him, because these are his own writings, okay? I looked up a lot of things that I had no idea, things that he had written on the subject of homosexuality. He's written quite a bit about homosexuality. He's written in defense of homosexuality, but always from the point of view, but without ever really saying it, but saying that he was, you know, like you're supposed to assume that he's not, but he's writing about it from the point of view of a white nationalist who cares about white nationalism, its future, and its, the health of it, and so on. So he wrote something called Lawyers and Sex Crimes: Further Thoughts on Covington's Northwest Quartet. And I couldn't find the actual date of that, even though I have the link to it. But it's on the Occidental Quarterly online. He was the, I think he wrote this when he was had a position on the Occidental Quarterly, an editorial position. I'm not sure about that either, but he did have he was editor of the Occidental Quarterly at one time, and then he was editor of the online version. Maybe he was only editor ever of the online version. But he says, he wrote this in answer to, he said in this that this was what was left on the cutting room floor after he wrote something else because it was too long. and he thought it was pretty good, so he published it separately. And when I started to read it, I mean, from what my impression of Greg Johnson was, I thought it was kind of odd that he would write about Harold Covington, since I see, you know, saw Greg as a real intellectual of the René Guénon variety, and I didn't see Harold Covington in that way. But then I discovered that Harold Covington is also said to be a homosexual, though he is on record as denying it, and his ex-wife of his has said that he was, and other people have said so. So, you know, these are these things I don't like to bring up. I don't like to get into this like it's gossip. But if you're really studying something that you think might be damaging to your people, then you know, you have to look at everything. So it turns out that there was a friendship between Greg and Harold Covington, and I mean they communicated, they knew each other very well, and Greg does not dismiss Harold Covington, or he used to take him seriously. Well, because the fellow at the West's Darkest Hour, who I'm going to bring up a little bit later, also takes Harold Covington seriously. At least the Northwest Movement he takes seriously. So so here we have where Harold Covington is on record as saying that homosexuals are enemies of the white state and should be murdered like all other mentally ill whites. You know, once there is a white state and you have to kill the traitors and the enemies of the white state, homosexuals are among those. And Greg Johnson wrote this defense of homosexuality in reaction, in response to that. So I'm going to quote some from the full article. It is, Greg writes, I think that homosexuality is neither a sin, which he defines as an offense against the God of the Jews, nor an illness, but rather it is something that might be called a natural suboptimal condition, like baldness or myopia or propensity to pack on the pounds. That is something that some people just have, like a particular kind of gene that causes you to, you know, become bald after 35 or to add a lot of pounds or something, whereas other people don't. But he says, now I'm still quoting from this article, let's just grant Covington's premise for the sake of argument. So what about all the other mental illnesses? Covington does not mention if melancholics, manic depressives, schizophrenics, paranoics, compulsive liars, kleptomaniacs, alcoholics, and other sufferers of mental maladies will be marked for death. The reason for this is obvious. Homosexuals are marked for death not because they suffer from a mental illness, but because the Bible, the Jewish Torah, tells us so. This is probably the source of the extreme animus toward race mixing as well. It is, to put it mildly, a rather astonishing lapse. Oh, this animus toward race mixing, he says. It makes it all too easy to parody white nationalists as Bible-thumping hayseeds and hillbilly psychopaths. It also serves to drive otherwise sympathetic and useful individuals who might be guilty of nothing more than an experimental homosexual or interracial dalliance while in college or the military, where such experimentation is common, into the arms of the system for protection. What would Aryan reason, as opposed to Jewish superstition, dictate in dealing with homosexuals and race mixers? This is the question Greg asks in this article. He says, you know, we need to look to Aryan reason as opposed to Jewish superstition. He says, of course, and I took out a little part here. There's a gap here, and then I'm continuing a little further on in his article. Of course, there would be no problems excluding homosexuals from the pup tents of Boy Scouts, the locker rooms of school children, or the barracks of the military. There would be no nonsense about homosexuals marrying or adopting children, which seeks to erase the distinction between the normal and the abnormal. Should society also be, well, he just, I won't even add that sentence. It's just, he's saying that, he is saying that homosexuals don't have to be given whatever they want. If they want to get married or adopt children, that doesn't mean they have the right to do so. and the state shouldn't give them that right. And O'Meara also was very much against marriage of homosexuals. I don't think I brought that out, but he talked about that. And because they're not, this particular whole group of right-wing homosexuals is not interested in marriage at all, and they don't feel the need. They're not homosexuals that want to marry one another and have families. They want to create culture. So he goes on to say, the question of race mixing is more complicated. First, the problem is not interracial sex or marriage per se. The problem is interracial babies. Of course, there are no interracial babies without interracial sex, but not all interracial sex produces babies. The problem with multiracial societies is that interracial sex is inevitable because it is perfectly natural and normal for people to take advantage of a wider range of possible mates and sexual partners. Well, that may be somewhat true, but I don't think that everybody wants to take advantage of a wider range of mates and sexual partners. But homosexuals really do, and that's something that's known about homosexuals. They're not interested in marriage. They're not. They may have long-term friendships and relationships, but they're not interested particularly in being faithful to one person. And they certainly like to have, we know that they're traditionally when people are making fun or putting down homosexuals, that's one of the things that's talked about is the fact that they want to have a lot of partners. Also, he says, what's wrong with this argument is that if you are having sex and no babies with a cross-racial partner, it means that you're not having sex and babies with the same race partner. So people are, you know, may not be, and this is going to come up when I read from the National Socialist article about this or policy about this, about homosexuals. That, you know, that if you are playing around as a homosexual, even if you don't create babies and create a problem that way, you're still not doing your job as a member of your race and creating white babies with a white partner. So now he says, what should be the attitude of a white nationalist regime to race mixers? I'm bringing this in because it's kind of interesting. First, he says, all whites who produce offspring with members of other races have, in effect, left our race for another. One cannot mix one's blood without mixing one's loyalties. We cannot reasonably expect that such people will be more loyal to their extended racial family than to their mixed-race children, and no white nationalist would ask them to. They could not, therefore, be citizens of a white ethno-state, much less would be white nationalist leaders. Whites who have married non-whites without offspring or prospects of offspring clearly belong to a different category, but it is not clear that a different policy should apply. Well, of course, here again, if you are a homosexual male group living outside of these societies, norms of marriage and family and raising children and so on, you can't be guilty of anything, even if you should have a sexual liaison with a mixed race person, which I wouldn't put it past a lot of them who are clearly prefer whites, but they might do that. But because no children are issued. So the only people who are vulnerable to all these rules are those who are willing to mate with women, you know, males and females who are willing to mate together as is necessary to produce offspring. So he says, within the movement, we need to be willing to tolerate inessential flaws and past mistakes on the condition that people are honest and transparent about them. Well, you know, I underline that because a lot of these people, and himself included, are not being honest and transparent about their flaws and who they are and what they're doing. Not at all. So, but he's saying one can build with flawed materials, but only if one knows where the flaws are. I think that's an important sentence. We don't want to put the guy who is hiding his dyslexia in charge of editing, the guy who is hiding his agoraphobia out distributing literature, and so on. I mean, people who don't fit the job shouldn't be put in those jobs. He says, a weakness is compounded by concealment. And there again, there's a lot of concealment in the homosexual community. It does not become a virtue by being flaunted. It's true. He said, we don't want to flaunt things. But he says, when one is willing to acknowledge one's flaws, that is the first step toward rising above them. It is an opportunity for moral growth, a way of strengthening one's character. Thus, we have to penalize concealment and reward transparency. He's put all these articles by these two admitted homosexuals, James O'Meara and Jack Donovan. Well, they're proud of it. I mean, I'm not saying that they're, they're quite happy and proud to be what they are. He's put all those articles on Countercurrents by them and other homosexuals. And yet, and why is he doing it? Because they're so good? Because there's not as good as stuff, other good stuff written by those who are not? This is a question that has to be asked. So it may be, I am thinking, that he is about ready to admit that he is. And so by putting all this stuff on, it might raise some questions. Maybe I'm helping to bring this about tonight. Maybe he's happy with what I'm saying. Who knows? Anyway, he ends here. For a white nationalist revolution to have any moral authority, its leaders must not just lead us to regaining control of our racial destiny, they must also lead us in self-criticism, self-purification, and atonement with the greater racial body. So that's quite, that's his ending, and I just have to ask, we need to ask who's actually doing this, if these people who are setting themselves up as leaders are doing this. I want to turn now to Chechar of the West Darkest Hour blog, which he translated this Chechar. He's got a pretty good blog there. A lot of people follow that. And he's friends with all of these people I've mentioned. They all talk about each other, post each other's work and so on. But Chechar presents himself as absolutely not homosexual, so I have to believe that. And he translated something about homosexuality that Greg Johnson posted at Countercurrents in French. He was surprised. He said he posted this thing, but he posted it in French, so only people who speak French could read it. So he translated it, put it on his blog. I'm losing my place here. Put it on his blog so that we could all find out what Greg wrote on that, because he was a little unhappy with Greg for some of these reasons that I'm talking about. And he says, Greg says that first he protests the queer bashing at VNN. That's why he wrote this. He protests the queer bashing at Vanguard News Network and there, and also on their forum, which is VNNF. Which is Alex Linder's site. And I went there. I found a lot of interesting stuff there. I don't normally go there. I'm not a member of any of these forums. I don't post at them. But I did go and found what Alex Linder had to say. So Greg wrote this in response to what Alex Linder was saying. And the queer bashing that was going on. And that's what he called it. Then he gives two arguments for why it's misguided. Again, he's defending the homosexuals and why tolerance is a good thing for the white nationalist community. This is all exactly as Chechar translated it and wrote it. Number one, and I've edited this down to make it a lot shorter. But the number one point Greg makes, and he makes only two points. Number one, homosexuality is beside the point. Okay, we shouldn't be concerned with that. He says the distorting lens of the Jewish media makes us think that all homos are promoters of the Jewish agenda. But white nationalism is a one-issue politics, he says. The interests of whites against the interests of our racial enemies is what it's about. Therefore, homosexuality is beside the point. He said a lot more, but I don't have time for it, so I just pulled that out as the essence. Number two is intolerance of homosexuality is Jewish. We hear this again. This is a refrain that comes up again and again. Even though we know that the Jews are promoting, Jewish media is promoting homosexuality in our culture, they promote it for us, but they're, of course, they're not tolerant of it in their religious communities. They're very intolerant of homosexuality and very big on families and lots of children. But that's in Jewish religious communities. That's not in their secular community. But the Jews are really promoting homosexuality among whites. That's what they're doing. But this is not brought out this way. Under intolerance of homosexuality is Jewish is if you ask Christians why they think homosexuality is a sin, they have to turn to the Old Testament, to the record of the Jews in their wanderings, crimes, superstitions, and hatreds. There we find homosexuality condemned as a capital crime. Why? The whole aim of the Jewish law is to set Jews apart from the rest of humanity. The Jews condemned buggery because they and all their neighbors were engaging in it. And he says homosexual pedophilia, which still remains a taboo in our culture, was widely practiced in the ancient Aryan peoples of the Mediterranean world. The Persians, Greeks, and Romans all practiced it, including some of the manliest men in history and legend, like Achilles and Alexander the Great. So, I'm going to stop here because we're almost to our break, and we will have a five-minute break, and then I'll be back. But here, this is the theme, hatred of homosexuality is Jewish. Acceptance of homosexuality is the Aryan ideal of the golden, of a better ages than the one we live in now. So this is something I'd like you to think about over the break while the music plays, and stay with me, and I'll be right back in a few minutes. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour, broadcasting from the White Network on this Monday, June 4th, 2012. It's always good to bring that up in the second hour so that people haven't forgotten what program this is. And I am discussing what I have titled The Homosexual Menace. Not that I'm an expert on homosexuality, but I seem to be a person who is willing to talk about things that other people are not willing to talk about. And so here I am talking about it. And I've explained in the first hour how this came about. And I have been discussing some writings of Greg Johnson's, who is the editor-in-chief of the countercurrentspublishing.com website, which is a beautiful-looking website and very interesting. But it has a lot of things that as I said, all of these articles by homosexuals who don't make any bones about their homosexuality, reading things on that website, I go to the things that attract my interest and I bypass things that don't, and I don't even notice a whole lot of what's on there. This is why these things go kind of under the radar. So another piece of writing that's available I'm going to go through it as just a few points in it, that is Greg Johnson's email to Jim Giles. Jim Giles has a radio program. He's, I think, in Mississippi or something. I've listened to it, I don't listen regularly because I forget that it exists. You know, I forget a lot of things because I only have so much time. So, but on this, in this email, Johnson, I guess, canceled out of a radio interview with Jim, and then he sent him an email explaining why, and he told Jim Giles that he could publish it if he wanted to. And so Giles did. And I think he read it on his program. And this is what part of what Johnson said was he was complaining about Alex Linder. And he said the reason that he didn't go on the program was because of he was angry about Linder, I think. He said, Linder called me a homosexual because he was pissed at me for publicly disagreeing with his constant diatribes against Sam Francis, Jared Taylor, Patrick Buchanan, and Peter Brimelow. These are people in the white advocacy movement who are well known. These are not homosexuals, but they are people who are not as don't have the same point of view and are not as radical as Alex Linder. He said, Greg Johnson said, Linder doesn't know anything about my personal life, but he was unscrupulous enough to make the charge anyway. So Greg Johnson is, at this point in time, which is not more than a couple of years ago, I don't think, denying clearly that he's homosexual. And saying that if people say he is, that they are really disparaging him. And he says, Greg says, there's no point in responding to accusations like that. See, he hasn't responded. He doesn't. One of the big complaints about him is that he will not come out and say, no, I'm not homosexual. So he gets around this by saying there's no point in responding to accusations like that because they are not honest. If you respond to one, he will just throw out another one. And then he goes on to, I don't want to spend the time reading all this, but Greg had taken on a pen name for a while, the Cat Lady. It's turned out that Greg has written under lots of pseudonyms, and one of them was this, the Cat Lady, and they were using that to say that he used that name because he likes pretending to be a woman. And he says that he created that because he was tired of white nationalists tired of hearing that white nationalists need to soften their message to appeal to women. So he created a female persona that was more hardcore than Alex Linder, he said. But when the reviews got a lot of attention, he regretted using that silly name. But then he says, well, a lot of other people use silly names. And then he changed his pseudonym to T.C. Lynch. You know, I had no idea he'd used all these pseudonyms, but there's, you know, I wouldn't, I'm not accusing him of that, you know. I'm not accusing him of anything. I'm only, like Alex Linder, observing things. You see, he says that Alex Linder called him, accused him of being called him a homosexual. What Alex Linder was doing, and he explained that over and over again, was simply looking at the evidence and saying what he thought was true and thinking that Greg Johnson should say so if he is. And Greg didn't, of course, has not liked this at all over all this period of time. So he had a big feud. He used to post a lot on Alex Linder's forum, Greg Johnson did. But all of this is, if you go into all that, you'll find it all for yourself. Now, Johnson then says, the people who donate money to Linder are otherwise involved with him need to ask themselves if they can risk further involvement with such a loose cannon. And then he says, Alex Linder is a sick individual mentally and physically. Every person he has associated with ends up bitterly regretting it. I hope you do not end up the same way. He's writing this to Giles. He turns around and attacks Linder. Because he doesn't like what Linder's saying about him. So, you know, we have these feuds. Now, people will say, oh, this is a terrible thing. I have always been, well, for a long time now, since I thought, you know, what I said had any mattered at all, that I don't think this idea that we should never open our mouth about another person because it's divisive and we should just consider that we're all on the same side. I don't agree with that at all, because I think a lot of things need to be brought out. A lot of things need to be talked about. And I have turned into a person who does that on my radio programs. And so here I'm doing it again tonight. Anyway, Greg finishes by saying, the only thing that matters is whether or not there are white people on this planet 200 years from now. Compared to that, personal feelings just don't matter. That's what he wrote to Jim Giles. Well, you know, I think that's very funny, amusing, or sad, because, you know, he should know that the more homosexuals we have, the less likely it is that there's going to be more white people on this planet 200 years from now. And yet he is constantly, if not promoting homosexuality, he's defending it. But he is promoting it because he's putting all this, featuring all this work and writings by homosexuals. And even if they are not admitting they're homosexuals, you're going to find things in their writings that are going to be defensive of homosexuals. And there's something I'm going to come up with in a little bit that's going to be a good example of that. So this, then he signed it, you know, and I bring up that when he says, that he's not a homosexual and he's not doing, you know, this is not important and people shouldn't be bringing it up. How does this square, as I really just intimated, with his posting 25 articles on countercurrents by the homosexual James O'Meara and 14 by the homosexual Jack Donovan in just a couple of years? And in Donovan's case, it was just in 7 months. And they argue that marriage and family values are Jewish and that the elite of the Aryans don't do that and, you know, are above that and have a different agenda for themselves. A more lofty one. How does that square with what he's saying here? In my mind, it doesn't square at all. And so I did another tally after I found out about those articles that I think is interesting. But I'm going to give it because it's about the programming on my former network, which I'm not trying to put down. We need all these networks. We need all these things going. But I do question a lot of the programming there, and I always have. When I was there, the whole time I was there, from this first program that Robert Stark had Jack Donovan on, and shortly after he started his program, I had already been there 2 months when Robert Stark started, and I was shocked to find out that he was interviewing a homosexual man, and I brought it up to Mike Connor at the time. Mike Connor is the only person that I ever had access to at Voice of Reason, and he really turned out shortly, sometime thereafter, to be the only person running everything there. So he's the one you have to talk to, and I always talked. I always complained about some of these guests that were being brought on these shows. So this is nothing new that I'm just saying now. Anyway, I did the tally there, and I found that Robert Stark on his the Stark Truth show, starting in May 2010, when he started, as I said, 2 months after I did, the number of programs he did interviewing homosexual men is seven programs, and three of these were homosexuals who were outed and discussed it, and I've already talked about who they were, two with Donovan and one with O'Meara. And the others, I'm sure are homosexual, but they're not. They didn't talk about that. Now, then he did the number of programs with non-whites that Robert Stark did. 10 programs with non-whites. Five of these non-whites were Jews, and five were something else. And so then I did Tom Sunic. And Tom Sunic began in 2009, 10 months before I did. So he's has a longer run, but he hasn't been producing programs for quite a few months now. But his tally was 13, less than Stark. But of those 13, 12 of them were with homosexual men. And only one of those was actually called homosexual, you know, was outed. That was Donovan. And to his credit, once Sunic interviewed Donovan, which was early on, that was the one that that I complained about. Did I say it was Stark? I didn't mean to. It was with Sunic that he had on shortly after I started there. To his credit, he didn't ask him back on again. And he seemed surprised when he found out that Donovan was admitting that he was a homosexual. But he has a lot of his interviewees were homosexual because they are these people in the in this rarefied esoteric book writing and reading and publishing area that he really gravitates to and likes, and so he interviews them. But he only interviewed one non-white, and that was Paul Gottfried, who's a Jewish, and he has had one program with him. So Tom Sunic has a lot better record than Robert Stark. But then I looked at Carolyn Yeager. I didn't have to look, but I did go through all my programs anyway. But my score was zero, not a one. You know, now, I did a lot of good programs there, and they were almost all interesting, good guests. I had some wonderful, intelligent guests, people with PhDs and so on. I mean, I wasn't scraping the bottom of the barrel in the least, but I didn't have to have any, I didn't have to find homosexuals or Jews or non-whites to do that. I never had a one, and it wasn't something that was a policy of mine, but I wasn't attracted. I never, you know, I never went toward those people. Although I might have had a program or two, but they didn't want to come on with me either. So there's something that there's a mutual affinity or there isn't. I'll stop at that. Now there's, what's my next thing? Well, I already said that, so I can skip that by. All right. Chechar. I got interested in him. I tried to find out what I had read him sometime previously. I thought he looked like he was a homosexual, but he insists he's not, and he's not too pleased. He doesn't want homosexuality and white nationalism. He's a very, very devoted, white nationalist. But he doesn't want white nationalist homosexuals to out themselves. He wants them to keep it all to themselves, which a lot of them are trying to do. But you know, you can't really do it. It doesn't really work. So what is he saying? Is he saying that it's all right, as long as they don't talk about it? No, he says he's anti-homosexual. He would like them not, he doesn't think that they fit, but if they are in there, he doesn't want them to be saying they are, you know, he doesn't want white nationalism to have a homosexual aspect to it or segment to it. Now, he says, can we really tolerate homosexuals in a real white community any more than we can tolerate Jews? Well, I say plenty of white advocacy groups do tolerate Jews, but I think that is totally compromising. I've talked about that. And I think so here's the question. Okay. What I'm getting at is, do homosexuals compromise us in the same or a similar way? Now, find my place again. I want to share with you now, there's something that I had, that I told you about earlier that I was going to share with you. That is by Anna in the comments. This came to me last March, was brought to my attention. The blog, A Jew Among You. That's another person that Robert Stark interviewed, Reuben Hyatt. He was writing about the Amran conference in March. It might have taken place in February, I don't know, but it was in March 23rd, these comments were going on his blog. And this woman who named herself Anna wrote this. She said, she wrote about a story about homosexuals and white nationalism. And this is how it goes. This story outlines the problem of having minorities in the movement. She says, minorities are wonderful at protecting their points of view and are very prone to becoming spiteful when they realize that they really aren't welcome in the European ethnocentric society. Okay, spiteful when they realize they're not really welcome, just like minorities. These would be in some. What makes a minority? Something that doesn't fit with the overall norm of society. And she says, I'll refer back to that alternative right post. So this must have been on the alternative right website. Somebody wrote a post there. And she says it's a perfect example of the problems. As a homosexual male was confronted by another white nationalist who suggested that a cure for homosexuality was soon ahead via the recent discoveries made regarding its cause. The homosexual said, and I quote, this is her writing this, no, and I'm not willing to tolerate your support for wiping out my cultural and genetic in-group. Anna said, imagine homosexuals identifying as a cultural and genetic in-group now, and how fast he shifted gears from doing the best for the white community back to his cultural and genetic in-group. And I really can't say that I am off when I realize the pattern in minorities immediately regressing to that state of mind. Jews are absolutely notorious for it, she says. So, yeah, you know, we can find Jews in the white nationalist movement. They're supposed to be helpful. They're anti-immigration. They're pro-white, blah, blah. And we find lots of homosexuals in the white nationalist movement who are pro-white and anti-immigration and all of that. And yet, what she's pointing out here is that they identify with their smaller cultural in-group more than they do, or genetic, more than they do with the larger white group. And when it comes to homosexuals, they will, if push comes to shove, they will revert back to their to defending the homosexuals over and above what's best for the white community. And the same with Jews, they will revert back to defending certain aspects of Jewishness or Jewish rights and so on, even if it's not in the best interest of the white community. I think this was a good example. I think she's right about that, and I saved that, and I'm glad I was able to use it here in this program. So now I'm going to move on to National Socialism and something that I'm going to read to you because I think it's so good. And in conjunction with this, I see a tendency amongst this white nationalist homosexuals to absorb Adolf Hitler and National Socialism. On the one hand, I say, oh, look, they're being very kind to Adolf Hitler. They're saying good things. They like him. That's good. But now I realize that they are kind of wanting to use that as a example of male dominant, a male, you know, these male groups that are apart from regular life and a haven for homosexuals. And they especially use the SS as a model for male bonding. Which I have nothing against male bonding. I'm all for male bonding. That is a good thing. This is not about male bonding. This is about homosexuality. But they see that this was part of a homosexual lifestyle, I think, but it's not true, because the model in the SS was always marriage and children for all German men. And the SS men were encouraged to not only have children, but to marry. This idea that they were encouraged to just impregnate white women wherever they go without getting married is not true. Not that it didn't happen. It was war, when, especially during wartime. But this was not the policy. And when this homosexual discussion was raging at VNN Forum, Alex Linder presented a copy of the National Socialist Policy Towards Homosexuals. And it was published in Das Schwarze Korps, the official newspaper, the Black Corps of the SS, probably in 1936. It's been translated by Carlos Porter. And I read it and I found it really interesting. So I'm going to read the whole thing to you now. And I hope without comment, so that you're smart enough to figure out what's being said without me pointing it out to you. So this is titled Enemies of the State. Did I say already that I'm probably not going to get to the revisionist part of this program? I know now I'm not. So if I'm able to get on Saturday with Vincent Reynard, I think I can include that then. All right, Enemies of the State, this is National Socialist Policy Toward Homosexuals. And it was published, it was probably written in 1935, published in 36. More than a year and a half have gone since the famous and once violently controversial provision of Article 175 of the Constitution in June 1935. This would have been a kind of a criminal code. This revision was necessary prior to the introduction of a new criminal code, since the wording of the old paragraphs offered no basis for the application of the legal concept of the National Socialist State. It may therefore be time to look at the practical results which have followed this change in legislation. Homosexuality is a field in which the bourgeois citizen's favorite flower is the touch me not. You know, meaning that it's one of those, like we say, no tell, what is that? I can't even think of it now. You don't talk about it in the military. The average person probably knows many people whose hair stands on end at the very mention of such a topic. But how poorly this problem lends itself to solution through the methods of the ostrich, and how seriously it affects every member of the racial community, is proven by the facts which confronted the new state when it began its work in this field. Following the accession to power, the new state drew up an inventory of clubs and associations embodying the third sex concept with vast torrents of scientific and intellectual verbiage. This puts those words in quotes as kind of not really scientific and not really intellectual. These organizations were then discovered to have 2 million members. If we subtract children and old men from the total number of male citizens of the Reich, now here are these men's organizations that our friends today are talking about. If we subtract the children and old men from the total number of male citizens of the Reich, 2 million men represents nearly 10% of all males of working age in full possession of their mental and physical capacities. Then he says, faced with this horrifying discovery that 2 million men were considered themselves homosexual, men of working age in full possession of their mental and physical capacities, they say the concealment or minimization of which would be criminal negligence. Okay, concealing this would be criminal negligence, because the state has only two possibilities to choose from: a delicate accommodation or a ruthless combat on this front. That it opted for the latter, a combat against it, was a matter of course, and any other choice would have been abject surrender. Even if the struggle against the pestilence of the racial community, the epidemic contagion of which was an inheritance from the era of liberalism, had not been the logical consequence of our racial ideals, the state would have been compelled to make hard decisions by its own saddest experience, which he is referring to the Rome Putsch. or the Night of the Long Knives. What appeared to be a tragic misfortune, a bitter stroke of fate, 1.5 years after coming to power, may, to the historians of coming generations, even look like a stroke of luck. The young state was compelled by a cruel fate which appeared to strike out against it, to take cognizance of the plague in its most dangerous forms, and to take up clear front-line positions. At a time when people were still inclined to view homosexuality as a medical problem, and to make cautious adjustments accordingly, homosexuality was found to be a political problem, capable of overthrowing weak governments. The value of this discovery can hardly be overestimated. It gave our leaders the inner conviction they needed to combat the medical problem with political weapons. Thus, the struggle shifted away from the field of science at the very outset. It no longer mattered against whom one struggled, but rather the ideal for which one struggled. The whom was of no importance, but the ideal was obvious to everyone. It was necessary to heal the German body politic, to maintain and reinforce the strength of the German people. Well, we can certainly put in place here that the white people of every nation need to be healed. We are in great need of healing in our body politic and in great need of strengthening. Goes on to say, experience shows that persons whose characters had been infected by this pestilence were mostly weak, unreliable, and mendacious people, sometimes subservient, sometimes power-hungry. People who, in the long run, were incapable by nature of holding political office in a community of the folk. But unless we assume from the outset that the 2 million people mentioned above are all of them unfit material for reinforcing the strength of the people, it is obvious that the plague still withdrew many. See, they're not assuming that all these people are unfit altogether for anything. They were just unfit for holding office. It is obvious that the plague still withdrew many, possibly hundreds of thousands of men from the reproductive process during their best years of their reproductive lives. We know that the National Socialist State of Germany was very concerned from the beginning to increase the birth rate, which it successfully did. We know how important it is for us to increase our birth rate, which we are not doing. And you can ask some of these culture leaders in the alternative right what they're doing about it. Not a one of them is doing anything about it. I'm not saying that I did anything about it, but I'm not preaching that now. I am trying to focus this. We are focusing this particular radio network on folk and family, so you can see where how this fits in with what we believe here. To continue, a people faced with the task of raising the birth rate by 1.5 million per year cannot afford the luxury of doing without a great proportion of its fathers, just because they have fallen victim to a decades-old unchecked attrition tactic directed against the health of the German people. The consideration defined the political task to be performed in the interests of the racial community. Defined the political task that they had to perform in the interests of the racial community. The task was clarified, first of all, with regards to the findings of experts who had puzzled over the etiology and symptomatology of the pestilence. The scientific knowledge of the outstanding experts, they put all this in quotes, in this field, whether we consult Kraft Ebing, Schrenk Rotzing, or Magnus Hirschfeld, we know the last one is a Jew, but I don't know about the other two, are always based on the assumption that homosexuality is an inherited or in any case, innate anomaly. The various experts only contradicted each other in the assumed causes of the anomaly. An anomaly is a deviation from the standard or the normal. Just like as I spoke earlier, it was brought up by Greg Johnson that baldness or a tendency to gain more weight than the average person, those are anomalies from the standard or the norm, and this is what homosexuality is continuing to be presented as, just so that they are just another version of normal that's just different. So, continuing, the resulting moral attitude expressly formulated by the Jew Hirschfeld, speaking in his own case, was simply a logical consequence. Homosexuality is inborn, like a cleft palate or a hare lip. Just as we may not punish people or persecute them for the possession of a hare lip, nor should we persecute homosexuals or place restrictions upon their personal freedom. The men who took up the task which confronted them in the Third Reich, this must be stated unambiguously, regardless of any humanitarian outcry, would have carried out that task unsparingly, even if Hirschfeld and company had been right. But their work led to a discovery which was surprising even to them personally. The number of anomalous cases was totally insignificant compared to the totality of cases treated. Of 100 homosexuals, not even 2 belonged to the class with which scientific research had heretofore been exclusively concerned. That is, as something that they couldn't help. This gives another face to the tear-jerking theory of the poor sick people who just can't help it. Our opponents may object that such police findings are very poorly grounded scientifically. People who have been arrested are motivated to portray themselves as capable of rehabilitation, and their statements are worthless, it is said. To this we reply, if we simply confined ourselves to the statements of criminals, we would obtain a much higher rate than 2%, since the whole theology of homosexuality rests upon their not being able to help it, in quotes. And the smartest of these criminals, the most experienced, are very quick to refer to Section 51, which I guess is based on that's something they can't help. But our responsibility, set forth for us on political grounds, is not concerned solely with the punishment of those who have committed criminal acts. It also comprises, you know, the criminal acts mean if you're caught doing homosexual acts in a public place or in a laboratory or, you know, with a minor or all these kind of things, they were considered crimes. And so this is kind of what it's talking about. It's not talking about going into people's quiet people's bedrooms, even in the Third Reich, and seeing if they're, you know, doing homosexual acts. That did not occur. That was only people who were out there doing it, you know, who were in the open in some way, shape, or form, which was breaking the law. So it says it also comprises educational efforts and finally an appraisal of success of which the persons affected are mostly unaware. Here's where the anomalous cases may be clearly distinguished from their fellow travelers and from those seduced by them. This is also a scientific method. It may even be the only scientific method, since its inquiries are not just concerned with cases which have not been sought out to fit the theory, but which cannot be generalized. It is directed at the totality of those indiscriminately washed ashore into police custody. If we simply take these men as they arrive, and if we observe them closely, we find them to be creatures without any strength of character, who have never exercised any willpower or felt any inclination towards character building, so that upon superficial observation, we might well conclude that they are incurably ill. But if we compel them to perform systematic labor, which most of them have never before experienced in their lives, if we segregate them from normal men under strict guard, now they mean camps, is what I think, what it seems to me, if we prevent them from playing the self-exculpatory role of their illness, if we compel them to look upon their failure as human beings, reflected in the faces of their own kind, a transformation takes place with astonishing rapidity. The patient, in quotes, gets well. The anomaly, in quotes, is found to be perfectly normal. He undergoes a simple phase of development through which he failed to pass in his youth. That's interesting, and there's a lot that can be said about that. That this is what causes a lot of it, is they just don't develop in youth. Certain things happen in some stage they don't go through properly. This leaves only the 2% of truly anomalous cases who, just as they constituted the focal point of infection in the outside world, now become the crystallization point of aversion, separating them as the chaff from the still usable wheat. The danger of this 2% exceeds all powers of imagination. 40,000 anomalous cases out of the 2 million, the truly deviation from the norm was only 40,000, who could easily be excluded from the racial community are, if allowed complete freedom, capable of poisoning 2 million other people. It will be objected that these 2 million must undoubtedly be inclined, due to weakness of character, to allow themselves to be poisoned. Of course, a race cannot consist solely of people as strong as an ox. All the more reason to protect the weaker. The science of hygiene was not developed solely for the benefit of people with a constitution of iron, who throw off every infection effortlessly, but for the benefit of the more susceptible. I like that very much as showing that there is a concern and a care for all the people of your, you know, of your racial group, of your national group. It's the same. Above all, we know that all human beings unconsciously pass through a period in which they are receptive to the poison to some extent. The life of the instincts awakens at a point of development at which the other sex has not yet appeared as a definitive object of desire. So they're talking about people of a young boys and girls of a rather tender age in some phase of adolescence. And experience unfortunately teaches that the carriers of this infection approach precisely youths in this age group, not openly, unfortunately, but behind the mask of the well-meaning friend who resorts to every conceivable subterfuge to conceal his true aim. We're familiar with this from so many stories that we hear over and over again. Back to the policy. This enormous number of petty offenders can only be explained by the misuse of youthful trust. An accomplice who wrings his hands before accusatory facts can no longer wash those same hands in innocence. For decades, the intellectual leadership of the German people tolerated open homosexual propaganda and even considered it a praiseworthy showcase of, quote, democratic liberalism, unquote. They stood by and did nothing when the youth movement of the pre-war generation fell increasingly into the hands of the inverts. They're talking about pre-World War I, of course. The inverts. These are the 40,000 who are truly different. They didn't reach for the horsewhip when the Wandervogel apostle, Hans Blücher, in his book Wandervogel, the German Wandervogel movement as an erotic phenomenon, and the gays talk about this. I've heard these people I've been talking about tonight refer to the Wandervogel as something that shows how they're in the mainstream, so to speak. Openly, but here the National Socialists say that these people, that when this open, when in this guy's book, he openly admitted that the Wandervogel movement would have been entirely inconceivable without inverts or without homosexuals, because an inclination towards a person, this is a quote, regardless of sex, was in the last analysis erotically conditioned. A Wandervogel need not be ashamed of his love for a younger comrade. That was in their traditions. There is nothing immoral about it, etc. Blücher admitted that it was no accident that one of the largest youth associations in the district was overwhelmingly controlled by inverts. Well, this is something that the National Socialists were very intent on changing and getting rid of. There's no doubt about that. Continuing, that is the theology with which criminals seek to win our youth. That they turn to youth deliberately is proven not only by their criminal tendencies, but by their criminal intent. That intent is aimed at destroying the community of the folk. One homosexual teacher, they say, can corrupt a whole school. One homosexual youth organization leader can corrupt a whole generation entrusted to him. One homosexual, quote, friendly fellow who just likes young people, unquote, and I'm aware of a few of those, can corrupt the youth of a whole district. These people are criminals against the state and should be treated as such. They are criminals against the state because they act from expediency just as much as from inclination. Constantly surrounded by their own kind, it's as soon as they hold a position of leadership, they become the superiors of dependent subordinates. Then they build a state within a state, a secret state, whose interests run counter to those of the folk, and which therefore constitutes an organization hostile to the state. Thus the circle is closed. They are not poor, ill people who must be treated, treated in quotes, treated medically, but enemies of the state who must be destroyed. And he is talking, they are talking about this core, this 40,000 that they found are the true anomalies and not the 2 million who got caught up with them. And this was taken from Das Schwarze Korps, official publication of the SS, probably very late 1936 or early 1937. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I thought that was worth reading the whole thing. I have about 15 minutes left, and I'm now going to turn to this comic book and shed, because I think it goes well with what I just read from National Socialist Policy, of what this comic book represents. And it's only one item in so many, but and I don't know how many people read comic books, but of course kids do. But it's really interesting because, I think I'll start this story that came out on June 1st. It said the Green Lantern of the series Earth 2 will be reintroduced as a gay man in June. The Green Lantern is a superhero. And, I'm going to go up to, and here's a quote from that article. It says, series writer James Robinson, they're talking about him. It says, besides his new, he's the writer, besides his new sexual orientation, the Green Lanterns, Robinson describes the new Scott as quite similar to the original, a philanthropic media industry billionaire who's kind of a cross between Mark Zuckerberg and David Geffen. Now, James Robinson, that's not a Jewish name, but you can be sure he's Jewish. You can be sure he's a Jew, but they change their names. I once saw something about all these comic book, oh, I know who sent it to me, all these comic book people who were doing, I don't know if it was a DC comic or not, but there were these comics about from a while back about the Nazis, American soldiers as heroes and Green Beret types, and then they were fighting the Nazis and the way that they portrayed the Nazis and the ridiculousness of it, every person who was involved with those comics, the artists, the writers, the owners, the this and the that, the publicists and everything. They were all Jewish, but a lot of them didn't have Jewish names, and the real Jewish name was given, because this person had done a lot of research on it. So you can be sure it's the same here. And for this Robinson to say that, to describe his new character, Scott, because, see, he was an older man. This guy started in the 1940s, the Green Lantern. His name was Alan Scott, who turned into the Green Lantern when he, because of this ring he found or something. And he went around, fighting evil. And he was an older man, and he was a philanthropist. And I don't know if he was then, probably, but now they've changed him into quite a younger man who's still quite, vigorous and wants to have an affair. And he is, but he is a philanthropic media industry billionaire. Can you imagine media industry billionaire going around fighting evil? What a turnaround. And he's a cross between Mark Zuckerberg, this guy says, and David Geffen. This is so obvious. I mean, this is all just so Jewish. Now, he's saying that the new Alan Scott that he's now created, instead of having Alan Scott come out as a homosexual, they just made a whole new Alan Scott who's younger. And instead of having a son who's homosexual, he has a boyfriend who's homosexual. And he says that he calls this Alan Scott a dynamic, brave, and honorable man. And he says he's an interesting, complex character that I think people will respond to on many levels. He's the epitome of heroism, and I hope that he's a positive representation of a gay man. Well, of course, see, this is all Jewish, and they want to create positive representations of gay men. So this is, to me, you know, being, I guess, rather old-fashioned, to have a superhero in the comics be a homosexual and have this, and not only that, but his lover is this young dark-haired and sort of dark-eyed, a little bit darky, sort of a Cuban-looking type or something, slightly built young guy. You've seen the pictures. So it's just amazing. And then in the frames that I saw that showed where they were talking, he arrived, you know, in China and Taiwan, I guess, and he was met by all these Chinese people, and everybody's so nice. And then they say, oh, we have a surprise for you. And there's his young boyfriend. And he rushes to him, and they have a big embrace and kiss. And then they say, well, they're going off to a tryst. And the boyfriend calls him love and so on. So it's just setting up. And they're not going to get married. You can believe that and settle down. He's going to remain the Green Lantern, and everything's, you know, they're going to have this exciting life in their romantic tryst. Now, this is the way they are pushing this into our world. And we know how much, I mentioned a couple of things in the beginning. We know how much is going on as far as all this homosexual agenda. So we have to ask, should we have this in white nationalism? I don't have an answer. But I will say that it should be discussed, and probably when my Saturday show gets going and we can have panel discussions, which won't be for a while, that could be a topic that could be discussed among, you know, three or four people. Probably it would be best to have four on a topic like that, so you get enough variation of ideas. But I think, this is a part of, are we going to sweep things under the rug? Are we going to ignore things because we don't want to bring out unpleasant facts or truths or difficulties about the white communities? And I like to call it, I'm not comfortable with the word white nationalism. I'm not uncomfortable, but it doesn't give me an image of anything. But white communities, I think, is something very real. And when we talk about white communities, then we get down to families and children and what is healthy and what is good for that, not all this esoteric Julius Evola stuff. So I'm sorry. It's not for me. All right. I do have time. To go into a little bit on this revisionism that I prepared. I didn't prepare much because I knew I wouldn't have much time. But I did ask the question in my announcement, whose interests are we serving in Holocaust revisionism? With Holocaust revisionism light and Holocaust revisionism hardcore or tough or strong. I'm making a quick break here. I hope you can forgive me for that. and I will just say that Holocaust revisionism is something that I am very committed to. I'm very interested in it. I care about it a lot, and I will not stop talking about it. So it will continue to be a topic for me on this on this new network, and. Right now, I'm going to say this. Okay, the debate at the CODO Forum, of which I am not presently a member, and I'm not posting there, but I have been reading it, and it is now and has for some time been a debate between those who consider themselves revisionists. There's no Holocaust believers, hardly. coming around there anymore. For the most part, their arguments have been soundly refuted, and most of them have just dropped away, and others that have come and tried to do anything, they don't have decent arguments, and they're eventually, they're eventually reprimanded by the moderator for dodging and doing things like that because they, you know, which is against the rules. So they've kind of drifted away, and they're for quite a while now. It's just been revisionists debating among revisionists about what is the best course for revisionism or any new information that comes up and so on. And I'm very interested in the difference between what I'm calling here the hardliners and the softliners. And I consider myself a hardliner. And I get frustrated and so on with the softliners because I don't think that they're effective. And they, in turn, don't think that hardliners are effective. But I'm going to give you some examples here, which won't take very long, that I did up from real posts on Kodo Forum that I had saved up and never had a way to use them. Some examples of things softliners say. All softliners say, "I'm on the same side you are, and we're all on the same side." When you disagree, and they don't want you to disagree with them because they want to remind you that they're on the same side. It's kind of like things I've been talking about tonight too, in the white nationalist movement. When people say, "We're all on the same side, so what are we arguing about?" Well, as though there's nothing to disagree about. I always find things to disagree. I find things to disagree about, and I've never said that I'm on the same side as you, or hey, we're all on the same side. And I don't know any other hardliner who says that. Only softliners say that. So that's a mark of a softliner. Softliners want to make sure the Germans are blamed for what they did or for starting it. They're sure that there's some blame there. That you cannot absolve the Germans. That's just crazy to them. I mean, they must have done something, or the whole world wouldn't be thinking that. And one thing that one of them said, "I guess you think that no Jews died at any stage of the war by the hand of a German soldier." That's the kind of thing they come up with. Now, there's no evidence for anything there. There's nothing specific there. It's just a general idea that it must have happened. And therefore, you can't absolve the Germans and start blaming the Jews, because the Jews are, they still see the Jews as the victims. And there's no way around that. Okay, I'll go on to the next one. This is similar to, another variation of this with softliners, is that they harbor the idea that Germany was the aggressor. And here's one quote. Germans in Germany have had to live with a lot, though some of them would understandably say they brought it on themselves, that the Germans brought it on themselves. Germany did start invading those around it, which directly and indirectly led to the escalation of the Holocaust. And hardliners know this. What am I trying to say here? Hardliners they know that these people are saying this, and they don't get caught up in this. They don't get caught up in that Germans can be blamed for the Holocaust because they started the war, because they're warmongers, or they destroyed Europe. All the softliners fall for this kind of thing. They can't get away from it. So, continuing. Softliners think satiric takeoffs of the film Downfall are funny. Okay, there's often that there's new versions of this film Downfall, which is a movie in which Hitler is portrayed as a greasy psychopath. Really horrible portrayal of him, but people take it and then put subtitles on it that others think are funny, and they're supposed to be funny. But you still got that greasy, ugly-looking guy playing Hitler, and the nutty stuff that's going on in there, which is not anything like it really happened. And so hardliners don't find this funny. Anybody who thinks this is funny, these things are funny, is definitely a softliner. Now, softliners also want to point to revisionist writers who are Jewish. They're always looking for Jewish revisionist heroes that they can say, well, look, here's all these good Jews, and we need to utilize them. And then another thing they do is they want to feel that they have to distance themselves from racists and neo-Nazis. And they come up with that a lot. And they call people racist and neo-Nazis, say we don't want to have anything to do with those racists and neo-Nazis. And hardliners are not concerned about that. They don't concern themselves about that at all. Another thing softliners say is the Holocaust didn't happen as described. But hardliners will say the Holocaust didn't happen. They don't have to add as described, because when you say as described, you're saying that the Holocaust did happen. Ladies and gentlemen, my time is up. I want to thank you very much for listening tonight. Continue to look at my website to see when I will be having my next program, and there will definitely be another Heretics Hour next Monday. Thanks again, and good night to all.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.